We still have just two pages to finish, I think, from chapter 4. The ones you've printed out, do they look like this? Do they have just Na2SO4 below this list? Okay, I'll add one for you too then. What is... in. All right. So, who would like me to get you a printed copy of chapter 5? I'll raise your hand. Count. Going to be pretty much everybody. Okay. So, I'll print 15 or so of them out. In the meantime, take a look through these oxidation number rules. And using these rules for known substances, you ought to be able to at least start to figure out what the oxidation numbers are for some of these other elements. So sulfur in Na2SO4 and phosphorus in P2O5 are the two that we'll talk about anyway. Okay? So let me run make some copies for you. You guys work on this and we'll talk about this in a few minutes. In oxidation reduction, what is being transferred from one thing to another? Electrons. So we use oxidation numbers as a way of keeping track of where those electrons are going to and coming from, right? So the rules that we have up here, really minimal things to memorize, because for a lot of these, it's a very similar number to the charge that we've talked about with ionic compounds. Even though the compounds don't need to be ionic to do this. We can have molecular compounds where we wouldn't normally be putting pluses or minuses, but we just do this to account for the electrons. So, elements, zero. Ions, oxidation numbers, just the charge of the ion. Oxygens, -2. Hydrogens, usually +1. Halogens are -1. And then, for everything else, all of the oxidation numbers add up to make the overall compound. So if it's a neutral compound, all the oxidation numbers add up to what? Zero. And if it's a polyatomic ion with a -2 charge, all of the oxidation numbers will add up to what? -2, for instance. Okay? So for this first one, we wanted sulfur. Okay? In Na2SO4. And there's actually two ways of doing this. Okay. What would be one here? I'll just pick somebody. Did you guys down here have anything you started with on Na2SO4? No? any ideas? Anything in Na2SO4 that fits any of our rules? Sorry? Is that better? Step 3, oxygen. Okay, so oxygen is -2. There are how many oxygens in this formula? Okay, so. All right. What do you suppose I ought to do about that sodium? For both of them? For each of them? Yeah, for each of them. 2 times +1, okay. Plus whatever sulfur is, okay. That's our variable, okay. Thank you. Set them there, we'll get to them in a minute. Thank you very much. Good. So, +1. So 2 plus 1s, whatever sulfur is, plus 4 negative 2s, what's that all going to add up to?
0 plus 6.
It's all going to add up to 0, because all of the oxidation, the sum of the oxidation numbers in a compound is 0. Like this. This is a neutral compound. So do a little algebra, right? 2 plus S What? 2 plus s minus 8 equals 0. S equals
6.
Okay. That's sulfur's oxidation number. Now, I mentioned to you that there's two ways of getting that same answer in this one. Okay? In compounds, it all adds up to 0. What's a different thing we could add up for in order to get sulfur? The sulfate ion adds up to 2 minus. Okay? Let's just say, or the sulfate ion, sulfur plus 4 of the oxygens, S minus 8 is minus 2, S equals 6. Very first one, elements, right? Oxidation number of an atom in a pure element. So just iron, or just H2, or just O2.
So that wouldn't apply to the sulfur.
No, that doesn't work with that sulfur because it's a part of a compound, right? So an element. So if you ever see O2 just by itself in a chemical equation or something like that, plus O2 gas or something like that, what is the oxygen going to be? 0, yeah. That's what that rule means. Okay? What we did there makes sense to everybody? I got the same answer either way I did it. You only have to do it once, but whatever. Okay? See if you can get it with P2O5 doing the same thing. This one's actually a little easier. What are they all going to add up to in this one? What will the sum of the oxidation numbers in P2O5 be? The sum of the oxidation numbers of the atoms in a compound is 0. P2O5 is a compound which contains no overall charge, correct? It's P2O5, no pluses, no minuses, okay, overall. It all adds up to 0. So that was rule 6 that you used to say everything adds up to 0. What's the other rule that you'll use? 3. Oxygen is minus 2. So what math should I start out with? 3? What?
5 times negative 2.
Yeah, 5 times negative 2. Okay, that takes care of our oxygens. What else? Say it louder?
2B.
Yeah, plus 2, whatever our phosphorus is, our variable, equals
0.
Okay. So, simplify. What first? Negative 10 plus 2p equals 0. Then what? Add. 2p equals 10. P equals 10. So, simple. As long as you understand, right, almost all of these compounds we deal with have oxygen in them, right? These polyatomic ions, they all have oxygen, make oxygen minus 2. Okay? If it's an ionic compound and you know the charges, okay, use those to your advantage. That's what we did with the sodium in sodium sulfate. You should be able to get it so that you only have one variable. Okay? Then just solve for that. If you're doing it for the whole compound, the sum is what?
0.
If you're doing it just for an ion, the sum is what? The charge of that ion. Okay? That's why we could have done it either way in sodium sulfate, for the whole compound or for just the sulfate ion. Okay? So, yeah. Let's read that. Is that something you think you'd be able to do? Okay. Practice those a little more on the questions in your textbook and the ones in your lab that you have to deal with, and you'll be fine on that. Okay? So, let's talk about identifying and differentiating between oxidation and reduction. Oxidation is a loss of electrons, and reduction is a gain of electrons. And there are a couple of mnemonics, a couple of little handy remembering thingies you can use to help so you don't forget that. Anybody heard one?
Oil rig.
Oil rig is a very common one. Okay. Where, just taken from those words, oxidation is loss, reduction is gain. Okay, that works. Oil rig. Anyone heard the other one? Leo and Gur. Leo the lion says Gur. And that's one that I always learned. And it's always been funny to me that chemists always say Leo and Gur, and biologists always say oil rig. You'd think it would be backwards. So, still in my head, a lot of times when I'm doing oxidation and reduction, I say Leo and Gur in my head. Right, that's just the way it's been ingrained in me. So whichever one you want to use, okay, if you're taking a biology class or something like that, oil rig is a very popular one, but whatever. So being able to identify an oxidation or reduction based on whether electrons have been lost or gained, respectively, okay, is a key to all of this. And well, look at this. If we lose electrons, oxidation number increases. If we gain electrons, oxidation number decreases. Why is it backwards like that? Yeah, exactly right. Electrons are negative. Okay? If we have a minus 2 oxidation number, that's 2 electrons that were added. 2 electrons that were gained, essentially. Okay? So, if you just remember, electrons are negative. That makes that identity there. Okay. The other thing we'll throw at you is oxidizing agent and reducing agent. An oxidizing agent is something that is itself reduced. Okay. Because there's a transfer of electrons, one thing has to be giving electrons away, and something else has to be accepting those electrons. So whenever there's an oxidation, there will be a reduction also within that same reaction somewhere. So if something is an oxidizing agent, it causes the other thing to be oxidized, but it itself is reduced. Okay? So if it causes something else to be oxidized, okay, and it itself is reduced, that means it's getting electrons from something else. Okay? An oxidizing agent pulls electrons from something else, causing it to lose its electrons, causing that other thing to lose its electrons, and it itself is reduced. It gains electrons itself. Okay? So whenever we're talking about agents, it's just the opposite. Okay? An oxidizing agent is reduced. A reducing agent is oxidized. Okay? So it's sort of like, if you're studying English grammar, you know, it's like the indirect object and the direct object, the thing that it's performing the action on versus what happens to itself. Right? Use whatever, but I could stand up here and blab about that the whole time and you won't get it anyway. I didn't understand it at all just reading about it myself. So what you have to do is you just have to practice it, and you have to figure it out, and you practice it a couple of times, and that's how you get it. So that's just how it works. All right, I have a simple reaction here. 2 sodiums plus chlorine gas makes 2 sodium chlorides. Let's identify elements that are oxidized and reduced, and identify the oxidizing agent and reducing agent. And to do this, we're going to assign oxidation numbers, because that's how we keep track of where these electrons are going. So let's do that. What did we say about individual elements?
0.
So chlorine, zero. Cl2 is an element itself. So overall, it's zero, as well as the chlorines, as well as both of those two chlorines that are attached together are zeros. Okay? Anything? No. Only the halogens are minus one when they're in a compound. Okay? So over here, what's chlorine going to be? So that, what's chlorine going to be over here in sodium chloride?
Negative one.
What's sodium going to be? Positive one. Okay? That's important. We have elements over here. We have a compound. NaCl is what kind of compound? It's an ionic compound, so those oxidation numbers are the same as the charges. Okay? All right. Let's track sodium to sodium, then chlorine to chlorine. Okay? Here's sodium to sodium. Here is chlorine to chlorine. Okay? If the oxidation number for sodium went from 0 to plus 1, has it gained one electron or lost one electron?
Lost.
It has lost an electron. Okay? Electrons are negative. So if it loses an electron, it becomes more positive. Okay. Is that an oxidation or a reduction? This is an oxidation. Na becoming Na plus means it lost an electron, so it was oxidized. Okay. Cl, it went from 0 to minus 1. So did it lose an electron or gain an electron? Gain, which means that process is a reduction. Okay. So, in this reaction, sodium was what? What happened to sodium? It was oxidized, right? What happened to chlorine? It was reduced. Okay? That makes sense so far? All right. Identify the elements that are oxidized and reduced. Sodium was oxidized. Cl2 was reduced. Sodium itself was oxidized. So what kind of agent is it? Sodium is the reducing agent. And Cl2 is the oxidizing agent. Chlorine is a very common oxidizing agent. Okay? When you pour bleach into your washing machine, a small amount of chlorine is formed, which serves as the oxidizing agent that cleans your clothes. Okay? So bleach is an oxidizing agent, and chlorine itself is sort of the active ingredient to that. Okay? If you have a swimming pool, they pour a chemical in there that forms chlorine within the water that acts as an oxidizing agent that kills the bacteria. Okay? So things that are oxidizing agents are themselves reduced. Things that are reducing agents are themselves oxidized. When we're asking what is the oxidizing or reducing agent in this reaction, look for reactants. Okay? It's going to be either this reactant or that reactant. Those are the two agents. Okay? Those are the things that will, the product will not be an agent. It's a forward reaction. This is what we've formed, so it's done when we get there. Okay? So look for this one or that one. All right. I even say that here. It's the reactant, okay? Meaning it's one over on the left. All right. Let's talk about a specific type of oxidation reduction reaction that we encounter quite a bit in this course. And overall, the combustion reaction is an oxidation reaction with O2 as a reactant. Yeah?
Question.
Go
ahead. For the oxidation reaction, when you have a reaction that has another ion or another compound in there,
three.
Yeah.
And that one doesn't change. It's just going to left.
Yeah, that's nothing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep, that's nothing. Similarly, you could have just one reactant, and one element from that was oxidized, and the other element was reduced. In which case, that whole compound is both the oxidizing and the reducing. Okay. So, specifically, if we have O2 as a reactant, we call it a combustion reaction. Okay? And typically, these reactions happen, well, I guess sometimes these reactions are accompanied by light that's given off and heat that's given off. And what would we normally call that? Yeah, flame or fire. Anytime something burns, it's reacting with O2, making products. It gives off light, it gives off heat. That's what we call fire or flame or burning. But really, that's a combustion reaction. That's just a type of oxidation and reduction. So we've encountered this before when we were doing combustion analysis, right? That carbon-containing compounds undergo combustion to form CO2 and H2O. So that means we can write an equation for the combustion of C6H6. It'll be C6H6 plus what? O2. When it's combustion, we have plus O2. So carbon-containing compounds, our products will be what? CO2? H2O? This equation needs to have what done with it before we can do much else, though? It needs to be balanced. If I did 6 and I did 3, then I have an odd number of oxygens, right? So how many oxygens do I have over on the right here? 6 times 2 plus 3. I have 15 oxygens, right? So if I did 15 halves, it'd be balanced, but then to cancel out the fraction, I'll just make that 15 and then double the other ones. So 6 becomes 12, 3 becomes 6. Then I should have 24, then I should have 30 on both sides. Okay? So let's find the oxidation and the reduction, and then the two agents in this. So you have three elements to choose from. Okay? That probably means the oxidation number of one of these elements is not going to change. So in the reactants and the products, assign oxidation numbers to each of those elements, to C, to H, to O. Okay? So start with that. Then find the ones that change and figure out whether that was an oxidation or a reduction. Okay? So take just a moment and do that. Oxidation numbers. I'm going to track it from the left to the right. Did you guys find the element that doesn't change its oxidation number? Hydrogen? So, what rule of thumb did you use to figure out C6H6? Hydrogen is always what? Plus one. What does that mean? Carbon has to be in this compound. Minus one. Now, that's not its charge. Carbon is not a negative one ion. This is just what we use to keep track of where the electrons are going. Okay? So, it's a little bit artificial, but it works to figure out whether electrons are gained or lost in the reaction. What is it? It shares its electrons with hydrogen to make covalent bonds instead of ionic bonds. So it's neutral. Regular carbon. Yeah, carbon doesn't really make ions too much in ionic compounds, like sodium. I guess you could say it's something like sodium carbide,
It would be kind of like a -4, but not really. It doesn't behave like oxygen does in sodium oxide or sodium chloride or something like that. It's different. All right. What about O2? Zero, because it's what? Because it's an element. Okay? It's an element alone, so it's zero. Okay. In CO2, what rule of thumb do you use? Oxygen is -2, which means carbon in this compound is what? Plus what?
Plus 4.
Okay. Hydrogen in water is what? +1. Oxygen is -2. Notice in each of those compounds, those add up to 0, right? 1 plus 4 and then 2 minus 2s is 0. 2 plus 1s and then 1 minus 2 is 0. Okay? Everybody get those? Any questions on those? All right. So, you mentioned that which element does not change?
Hydrogen.
So hydrogen is not being oxidized or reduced here. So let's not worry about that. Carbon, though, is changing. Oops, too far. There we go. Did carbon gain electrons or lose electrons? Lost. So it was what? What happened to carbon? If it lost electrons, it is oxidized. Okay? That's good. So what's the other element we need to worry about? Oxygen? Okay? It goes from 0, and we can draw it over here to either one of them, because they both go to the same number. But oxygen, did it lose or gain electrons? Gain. So oxygen was what? Reduced. Okay. Carbon was oxidized, oxygen was reduced. What is the oxidizing agent here? Oxygen. I mentioned chlorine is a great oxidizing agent, so is oxygen. That's why oxidation is called oxidation. Okay? So O2 is an oxidizing agent. It oxidizes things. Okay? The reducing agent is what? Just carbon? Any of these agents are actual reactants present. So, which is the reducing agent?
It would be C6H6.
That's right. If you wanted to be precise, you could say the carbon in C6H6, if you wanted to. But those agents always go per compound. Okay? That makes sense? All right. Let's do one more. Metals undergo combustion to form metal oxides. So something like zinc. If I want to burn up some zinc... You guys burned up some magnesium under the hood. Okay. Say I wanted to burn up some zinc. What does it combine with?
O2.
Okay. It's going to make a metal oxide. Okay. So, first of all, what was zinc's oxidation number originally?
0.
What is oxygen's oxidation number originally?
0.
Okay, good. So the zinc will form, the compound will form, will be some metal oxide, but you have to figure out what charge that metal is going to turn into. Okay? We said that zinc, even though it's a transition metal, is a fixed charge ion. Anybody remember what the only charge zinc can form is?
+2.
Yeah. So if I'm making an ionic compound with zinc and oxygen, and the zinc is +2, what's the formula for the product going to be? ZnO, right?
where the zinc's oxidation number is 2+, and the oxygen is 2-. Okay. It's not balanced, though. What do you have to do? 2 in front of zinc oxide, then 2 in front of zinc. It's a common mistake for students to say Zn plus O2 makes ZnO2. Okay. But that would be zinc with a 4+ charge, and zinc doesn't make 4+ charges. Zinc only makes 2+ charges. Okay. So it's important that you don't purge that information from your head just yet about fixed charge metals. Okay. We had group 1 and group 2 were fixed with plus 1 and plus 2. Then we had aluminum, which was what? 3. Okay. It went diagonal. Aluminum was plus 3, then zinc was 2, and silver was 1. Okay. All the other ones are variable. So you probably wouldn't be able to make you wouldn't be able to predict with what we know now which metal oxide would form. Okay. So copper, right, you wouldn't know if it was copper 1 or copper 2 or whatever. Okay. There are other things to consider, energetics, that we'll deal with later on that determine that. Okay. So was zinc oxidized or reduced? What do you have to ask yourself first? Did it gain or did it lose? Okay. Well, what did it do? Lost. So zinc was oxidized. Oxygen was reduced. Okay. O2 is the what agent then? Oxygen, O2 is almost always going to be the oxidizing agent. Zinc is a reducing agent. Okay. When iron undergoes a reaction like this, what do we commonly call it? Yeah, we form iron oxide, which is rust. Right? So iron rusts, or now we can use a little more precise language and say that iron is oxidized in the presence of oxygen to make an iron oxide. Okay? So in your lab report, which is due on Wednesday now, right? Remember we talked about that, the reactions lab is due on Wednesday, so you'd be able to have this and have a couple of days. Wednesday at the normal time, Wednesday at 3 is when that's due. Okay? In any of your oxidation reduction reactions where you observed a change, you have to do an analysis like this. Okay? So, write out the oxidation numbers. Tell me what was oxidized and what was reduced. Tell me what the oxidizing agent is and what the reducing agent is. Okay? For any of the oxidation reduction reactions that you do, just this analysis that we did right here is what you need to do. You don't need to draw the arrows like that in your report, but if maybe just on the line above or the line below, you tried to line up the oxidation numbers or something like that, just so I can see. If you said something totally wrong, I just want to know which number you misassigned or something like that. Okay? So don't try to draw arrows or anything, but then say the carbon was oxidized, the oxygen was reduced, just in little sentences underneath. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. And that's due, when's that due again?
Wednesday.
Okay. Your mastering chemistry is due Wednesday night. Okay. So I always make them due before midnight, so Wednesday night is when your mastering chemistry is due. Okay. I think that's it for chapter 4. If you have questions, any of that? All right. Chapter 4 is done. Well, as you're studying, I guess chapter 4 is just beginning, right? All right. Hold on. Okay. Chapter 5. I gave you notes to work with here. Chapter 5 will correlate nicely with the lab that you'll be performing today that you've all read about. We'll get some added insight into the behavior of gases in lab today. So let's start talking about the basics of what we can learn about the properties of gases, and then how we can predict how changes to those gases will affect other properties. Okay? How pressure and volume are related, and temperature and so on. So we'll talk about that in lab today. The short answer is no. So we'll talk about that. You will not have two labs due on the same day. Okay? Because your lab from last time, the interface one, is due next Monday. All right. So gases, I already went through this when we talked just about matter to begin with. Are gases fluid or rigid? What does that mean? When something is fluid, what does that mean about that substance? Yeah. It can move, right? It somehow takes on the shape of its container, whether it's in all directions or just down and out. Okay? Fluids are in motion. And that's because of what property of their molecules.
Free.
Say that louder?
Free.
Yeah, they're free to move, right? Free, let's say fast, random motion. Of the particles, whether those are atoms or molecules or whatever it is. Okay? Is a gas compressible or incompressible? Gases are compressible, correct. If we have a gas in a container and we push down on that container, we can compress it, and that's because of what property of the molecules that it's made of? They're spread apart. Right? All right. So, we have a new property, new to this class anyway. We've talked about it in other courses, but pressure is a very important property to talk of when we're dealing with gases. Okay? The physics definition of pressure, it's just the amount of force per a certain unit of area. So pressure is force divided by area, right? Put a P in there. Why do we think of pressure with gases? If I have a gas that's locked in a container, right? Sealed in a container. How many there are in a certain area, okay? Yeah, that's right. Let's build on that. What is causing the force? Yeah.
Well, you could, if you have compressed air, you could use it to do work because of a force built into
the container. It'll push back, yes. Right? So, yeah. So what's causing that force? Collisions of particles with what? With each other? With the surface, with the inside surface of the container that they're locked in, right? So here's a surface, right? Here's gas molecules. Right here, right? Here's one that's striking. Here's one that's about to strike. That is the force exerted by a gas. Okay? It's when the molecules strike the inside surface of the container that they're contained within. Okay? Or if it's just open to the air, right? Or if it's just open, the gas striking any surface will cause a certain amount of pressure against it. Okay? So our atmosphere right now is causing a certain amount of pressure against the floor, against us, okay? Against the ceiling, everything. Why don't we feel that pressure? Why don't we feel the pressure of air molecules slamming against our hands like they are doing? Yeah. Because there's an equal amount of pressure inside of us. Okay? If you were to be dropped out in the near vacuum of space, what would happen to you? You would explode. Why? Are you being sucked out? No. What's happening?
It's
the pressure from inside pushes out because there's no pressure from outside pushing back against it, right?
Hey, if you like vacuum seal someone, like, have you ever heard of the experiment where you put someone in a garbage bag?
That's the weirdest
there,
thing.
And they can feel all the pressure?
Yeah, you can, yeah. I don't recommend sucking yourself inside of a garbage bag for liability purposes. I can't recommend that, but... But you could get that effect if you just put a plastic bag on your hand and it didn't have any air in it and tried to pull against it. Right? It would be really, really difficult to separate your fingers if there was no other air within that bag. That's because there's no air pushing out towards the outside. It's only the atmospheric pressure pushing that way. Okay? So when we're talking about gas, pressure is probably the most important consideration we have. So let's talk about some of the units of pressure that are important to us. The atmosphere is one of the most common ones that we use. One atmosphere is the average atmospheric pressure at sea level. Okay? So if we were at sea level, the atmosphere would be exerting about one atmosphere of pressure onto us. As we get above sea level, what happens to the pressure? It decreases. Why? Yeah, because there's fewer gas molecules pressing against any particular surface as you go higher up. Okay, just due to the density and due to gravity, I guess. If you get lower down, there's more gas molecules pushing against you. It's a even easier to think about if you think about deep sea diving. And we'll talk a lot about deep sea diving because pressure of gases is, and the physics of gas pressure is very important to scuba divers. So as you dive lower and lower and lower, there is more and more pressure of that water pushing against you because there is more water directly above you being pulled down on you by gravity. So similar thing happens with any kind of fluid. Yeah, absolutely. You're... ears are the way that your head at least equalizes some of its pressure, right? Because there is gas inside behind your eardrum that has to be relatively the same pressure as outside. Otherwise, when you pop your ears, somebody who take an AMP, that tube from your inner ear that goes back to your nose opens up and equalizes the pressure from inside of the thyroid. When there's less pressure, when you're up high, you have to equalize that pressure by reducing it inside of your ear that too. All right, so the atmosphere, okay, one atmosphere is sort of our reference point. When we have something open to the air, it's at one atmosphere. So an open container or anything like that. Millimeters of mercury... Okay. Is another common unit that we use. One atmosphere is 760 millimeters of mercury, and that's the same as torr. Okay, so 760 torr, T-O-R-R. So let's talk about where that comes from. We'll get to Pascal in a second. This is a barometer, and whenever you watch the weather, they tell you what the barometer is. That's just a measure of atmospheric pressure. That's what a barometer does. It measures the amount of atmospheric pressure at the certain altitude you're at and given the certain weather conditions of that day. So meteorology takes gas pressure into account. Right? The H's and the L's on the weather map are systems of relatively high and low gas pressure of the atmosphere that day with those weather systems. That's what causes any kind of change of weather conditions. So it's those pressures that are affecting each other and so on. So take a look at how this works. You make a mercury barometer by first filling up a big tube with mercury. Okay? You get it all filled up, and then you invert it into a pool of mercury. Okay? When did you do something a lot like this? When did you guys? Yeah, in the lab when you captured hydrogen. You filled up a graduated cylinder with water, and you inverted it inside of a tank like that. We do the exact same thing. So we invert it, right? There's no air inside of that tube. When we invert that tube of mercury, if it's high enough, though, the mercury will actually sag down a bit from the top. There's no air in there. That's a vacuum. Okay? Very important. No air. If you were to just look at that, you would say, well, there's some air in there. That's not what happened. There's a vacuum that's in there. So let's think about why that is. You have this pool of mercury down here that's open to the air. It's subject to the normal atmospheric pressure that pushes downwards on it. That force pushing downwards is what pushes the mercury, is what keeps the mercury pushed up in the tube. But if that tube is high enough, the atmospheric pressure is only strong enough to push that mercury up so far.
Why did it choose mercury? That's a very good question. It's carcinogenic. It's
pretty neat looking, but it's dangerous. Any idea why they choose mercury? Because it's liquid. Yeah, this better be a liquid. It's not going to work very well with sand or something like that. It's the only liquid in. It's the only liquid element. Right? It's the only liquid metal. What do you say, Chris? It's dense. Okay. What's that?
They didn't really know.
At the time, it seemed like a great idea anyway. No, the real answer is because it's very dense. I'll give you a hint. This exact same setup would work with water. Okay? When you inverted your graduated cylinders, as long as you had no air in them, no air bubbles trapped in them, and you tilted it up, did it do that? No. No. If you had no air bubbles in there and you tilted it up, the water went to the top of the graduated cylinder. Okay? So, what's the difference here? Well, mercury is very dense. It takes a large amount of pressure to force mercury, to keep mercury pushed up into that tube. Okay? Yeah. The weight of that mercury is pushing back against the atmospheric pressure. And what happens here, what we see here, is an equilibrium between the weight of that mercury in the tube and the atmospheric pressure that's keeping it up. Those two have equalized, so that's why it's just sitting there. Okay? In with just water, in your little graduated cylinder, there's plenty of atmospheric pressure to keep that pushed up in there. But it doesn't work like that indefinitely. If I had a tube of water that was 50, 30, 40 feet high or so, it would get to a point where it would no longer be able to be pushed up anymore. Yeah, that's right. So we could make a water barometer. It would just have to be really high. Okay? It's just inconvenient because water is much less dense. Okay? There's not enough of it pushing down to actually be in equilibrium. So what's mercury's freezing point? Minus 50, minus 100, something like that? Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Didn't I talk to you about that MacGyver episode a while back where they tried to freeze mercury? It has a really low freezing point, minus 100 or something like that. We need Celsius. Probably Celsius. Yeah. So, even lower Fahrenheit. All right. So, what we have here is a balance of the force, the weight of that mercury, and I didn't misspeak. I am actually saying weight instead of mass, because what is weight? Yeah, mass that's being pulled towards the Earth by gravity, right? So the weight of that mercury and the force caused by this atmospheric pressure have equalized each other. Okay? So the atmospheric pressure is constant, okay, no matter how big of that container it is. How can that be the case? It doesn't matter how big that reservoir is. The mercury will always rise up 760 millimeters on a normal day at sea level. Why is that? How come if I have a bigger container, it's not going to push that mercury up more?
Because the pressure can only push up 760.
Because what's pressure? Force per area. Okay? So If you have a larger area, you'll have a larger force, but it's per that larger area, too. So pressure is constant no matter how big your container is.
And what's the diameter? Does the diameter of the tube you use matter?
Nope. Because, again, you'll have a larger weight, right? You'll have more weight, but it's over that, over a larger area of the body. So the pressure pushing down and the pressure pushed down by the mercury are the things that are equal. So important to understand this, right? The key right here, that's a vacuum, that the atmospheric pressure and the mercury have equalized each other. Okay? On a normal day, that mercury will be pushed up 760 millimeters. Okay? So, less than a meter. A meter is 1,000 millimeters, so 760, about like that. So there are actual mercury barometers, and the mercury will be in a reservoir, and it'll be pushed up about that far. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there aren't too many of them anymore. They're usually digital barometers now. So that's why one atmosphere is 760 millimeters of mercury. That unit was renamed Torr after a physicist, Torricelli, Italian physicist that pioneered a lot of these ideas of pressure and barometers and things like that. So you'll see me use MMHG because that's what I'm used to. The book calls it Torr an awful lot, but they're interchangeable, just like milliliters and cubic centimeters. Yeah. So those are the same. The SI unit of pressure is the Pascal. One atmosphere is 101,325 pascals. So Pascal is an inconveniently small unit of pressure.
Is that exact?
I think it actually is. Yeah, I think as far as I know, that's an exact relationship.
What is the SI unit?
I'm sorry? Why is the SI unit so small? It has to do with how that unit was derived and how it relates to the unit, the SI unit of force, the Newton. So there's the definition of the Pascal is directly related to how many newtons there are per square meter or something like that. So this is a barometer. Another word that you should be familiar with is a manometer. It's not a manometer. It doesn't measure your manliness or anything. It's a manometer. It measures the pressure. Of a gas sample. Okay. So it behaves under the same sort of principle as the mercury barometer does. Okay. It's just instead of it being open to the atmosphere, it's a closed system. Okay. And there are pictures of them in the book. You can read about it. It's usually a U-shaped tube, and just the difference between where the mercury levels are and in this U-type tube is how you measure a difference in pressure. One other thing I'll tell you is that these are what are called absolute pressures. Did I tell you what absolute temperature meant before when we were talking about that? What is the unit of absolute temperature? Kelvin, okay? Which means something about zero. Yeah, zero means none on an absolute scale. Okay? Does zero mean none on the Celsius scale? No, zero is just any other temperature. Okay? So on an absolute pressure, zero means no pressure. Zero is a vacuum. There is such thing as relative pressures. Okay? PSI can be very commonly used as a relative pressure. So when you take out your tire gauge and it's just sitting there, you haven't plugged it into anything, what does it read? Zero PSI. Does that mean no pressure? No. That means it's relative to, what is that tire gauge relative to? Yeah, it's usually relative to atmospheric pressure, where one atmosphere is 0 PSI a lot of times. There are different PSI scales. There is actually an absolute PSI scale. There's PSIG and PSIA and things like that. It gets really confusing. So if you're going into engineering, don't forget about the whether your PSI is absolute or relative. That'll make a difference somewhat. So, but that's why we don't use, not only because PSI is an English unit, but it's commonly used relative. That's why we don't use PSI in our calculations. Okay? All right. So, let's talk about some of the simple gas laws, simple relationships. Well, you guys tell me, what did we say that a law was? Some kind of relationship, right? What's that? Observable. It's an observation, but not just one observation. It's
recurring.
Yeah, it's recurring. It's a summary of observations, right? Something that you can say in general, as this happens, then this happens. Okay? That's a law. Okay? So they're sometimes called empirical gas laws. Empirical just means that they're from experimental data. So whenever you see something that's empirical, that means it's based off of actual experiments that somebody did. So the names we're going to talk about here, Boyle and Charles and Avogadro even, those are people that did experiments with gases and determined what these relationships were through their experiments. So Boyle's law is the relationship of pressure and volume, and it talks about the compressibility of gases. Boyle's law, in fact, is an explanation for, or is a consequence of, I suppose, the compressibility of gases. So let's look at our little chambers here. I have a 1 kilogram mass sitting on top of this movable plunger with a pressure gauge hooked up to it. So this is a closed container. Okay? For this to be at 1 atmosphere, we had that 1 kilogram mass on there. If I change that into a 2 kilogram mass, we have compressed the container there. The pressure gauge here now reads 2 atmospheres. And it's no coincidence that I doubled that mass. Okay. What happened to the volume of that container? Yeah, I went from 1 liter to half of a liter. Why did the pressure increase? Yeah, there's less space between atoms. Think of it in terms of that actual pressure gauge. What that's doing is it's feeling the force of whatever molecules are hitting its little diaphragm inside of there, and that adjusts the little dial there. So what's different to that pressure gauge now that I've squished the container down to half its original volume? What's that? Yeah, hitting harder? Not harder. More often, right? Those molecules are moving the same speed. We'll talk about that in a minute. But twice as many of them are hitting over a certain amount of time, right? Because there's less space for them to, less actual area inside of there that they're able to hit. So let's make a little graph. Okay, got scales set up for you. Let's put volume on the y-axis and pressure and atmospheres on the x-axis. Okay? So let's just base it off of our little experiment up here. 1 liter, a half a liter. Let's put 1 liter here. Half a liter is half of it. I could do quarter liter, 0.25 also. And we can figure that out. Yeah? So at 1 liter, what did I say the pressure was? In this container? 1 atmosphere. Okay. So let's at least start with that. 1 liter, 1 atmosphere. Okay?
I compressed it to half a liter, the pressure did what? Went to 2 liters? Okay. If I compressed it in half again to 0.25 liters, what would the pressure be? Four. Right. I took the volume, I cut it in half, the pressure will do what? Double. Right. Is this a linear trend line? No. Something like that. Okay. It's a curve, it's not a linear trend line. As volume decreases, pressure increases. What kind of relationship did we call that? Yeah, these are inversely proportional. Pressure and volume are inversely proportional. Okay. There is something that I could do to this, though, in order to make it into a straight line. When you measured your ball bearings, okay, in lab, you fiddled around with one of the axes. You tried taking, you know, squaring it and doing other things with it in order to get a straight line. Okay. Any idea with what we would do to one of these axes to make a straight line out of this? If I squared it, I cubed it, I don't know. If I go, let's stick with 1, 2, and 4, okay? Because those are good, even numbers. Yeah. If I do the same thing with pressure, 1, 2, and 4, if I did 1 over the volume instead of just volume, right? And the unit then would be what? Not just liters, but 1 over liters. Right? I could say liter minus 1. Right? 1 would still be 1, right? Because 1 divided by 1 is 1. Okay. At 2 atmospheres, 1 over the volume is what? What's 1 over 0.5? 2. At 4 atmospheres, what's 1 over 0.25? 4. Yeah. What did we make there? We made a straight line. Okay? So, whenever we have two things that are inversely proportional, we can get a straight line by doing 1 over one of those versus the other, by taking the inverse of one of the variables. Okay? So I could say that pressure is proportional to, that's sort of like a Greek alpha. It's sort of like an infinity that's not quite finished. Okay? So looks like a little fish or something like that. That means proportional to. What is pressure proportional to? 1 over volume. What would volume be proportional to? If I wanted to increase my volumes, what would I have to do with pressure? Yeah. So, whenever I have an inversely proportional relationship, one will be proportional to the reciprocal of the other, or the inverse of the other. Okay? Finally, one more way I can write this. If I say volume is proportional to 1 over P, or pressure is proportional to 1 over V,
If I got both of those, if I got both of those variables on one side, what would they equal to? Think about that. I'll give you a hint. Proportional means pressure just equals some number times 1 over V. Yeah. The last way to say this is that P times V is a constant. So within one certain container, if you have one certain container that you haven't opened up, and these all assume a certain closed container. You can change the volume, right? Go up and down, do whatever you want with the volume. Okay? If you multiply pressure and volume, it will stay at some constant number. If you open it up and have a different situation, that'll be a different constant. But as long as it is, as long as it's that same container. So that's what we said here, right? PV equals constant. Right? Which means, and think about this, as I increase pressure, what has to happen to volume in order for that to be constant? Yes, you have to decrease. And vice versa. Remember the other place I had something times something equals a constant value? What was the other place we had an inversely proportional relationship? It was something with concentrations. Molarity. What's molarity inversely proportional to? Volume. Yeah. So the equation we made was M1 V1 equals, remember, M2 V2. We can do that same thing here. If PV is a constant, then P1 times V1 equals P2 times V2. And both of those equal some constant, but that's what we do whenever we have two variables that are inversely proportional to each other. Okay? A1 times B1 equals A2 times B2, whatever those two variables are. So M1 V1 equals M2 V2. P1 V1 equals P2 V2, simply because they're inversely proportional. So that allows you to take three of those and substitute for the fourth whenever you have two periods of time. Right? So this is the question we'll start out with next time, but you can sort of figure it out because you got three values, two have the same unit. We'll be able to solve for the fourth using something like this. Okay? So that's where we'll end. More gas laws on...